Anita O'Day in an arrangement by Jimmy Giuffre. It's 8 minutes after four. This is 91 FM, and you're listening to Fresh Air. And with me is Peter Max, whose posters and graphics were everywhere from the mid-60s to the early 70s. His psychedelic style was found in poster art, advertisements, logos. He animated the movie Yellow Submarine, and he received a lot of publicity during this period. So in the mid-70s, he decided to take a leave of absence from the public eye and did a lot of painting in his studio at home. Projects he completed during that period include the Expo 74 postage stamp and bilingual welcome murals for Canadian and Mexican U.S. border stations. In 1981, he created several Statue of Liberty paintings, and at the White House, he did this as part of the Reagan's 4th of July celebration. One of these paintings was presented to the president, who was also the official artist of the 1982 World's Fair. A show of his work will open tomorrow at the Halliwell Gallery in Conshohocken, and this retrospective will feature paintings, drawings, lithographs, and etchings from throughout his career. And for more information about this show, you can call 828-8666. That's 828-8666. Peter Max, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi, thank you.
A press release about you refers to the work that you did in the 60s and 70s as your early, your famous cosmic period. How do you refer to that period?
Well, that was a very joyous period. That was the times when, you know, from 63 till about 67, there was very strong Beatle influence. They're just coming in. I was in retreat at the time. I came out around 67. The retreat I just came out of was a 9-year retreat, which was my second one. But back then, it was a 2-year retreat. And I brought a Swami to America at that time. And people were studying yoga. There was alternate consciousness, and people were looking for new ways of life. And I was really in a hermit stage by myself, painting. And on a parallel level, as the Beatles were doing their music, I was doing that type of art. And actually, it wasn't. We didn't influence each other. It's just later on, somehow, just there was a big fit.
Your posters were considered to be very trippy. Were you into drugs at the time?
No, I was not. I was really very heavy into yoga. And I think from the meditation and the peace, I really started developing and loving making color spectrums and painting sages and saints and holy men and flyers and skies and stars and rainbows and doves. And that was my period. And I did that for about 2 years, a year and a half, too. By the time it came out and actually hit our times, which were the late 60s, I was already moving into a new phase, except the work that I did then was starting to be applied on posters and so forth. So the work that most people know that appeared in the late 60s, early 70s, were the things I did sort of in the middle 60s.
So what are your favorites of the posters or prints that we'd be familiar with? Which are your favorites now, looking back?
Oh, there's so many. I did 180 different posters till about 1972. I've done another 50 or 60 since then. And I think every second or third poster is a favorite for a month or two. There used to be one that was very favorite for me, which was called Midget's Dream. It was sort of a surrealistic, dreamlike, marbleized poster. Probably a lot of people listening have those or remember that. There was the Toulouse-Lautrec poster. Of course, the Love poster was one of the first ones to really get notoriety, and you know that they were sold widely, and that caused the poster boom to happen. There was a poster called Different Drummer, 2,000 Light Years, Man Must Moon. It was a poster I made to commemorate the landing on the moon, which happened in 69. And it was the same year that I was on the cover of Life magazine, where they just superimposed my face on the cover over a Different Drummer poster.
There were a lot of businesses who were trying to cash in on the youth movement and the youth market, contacting you and asking you to work.
Absolutely. When this movement happened, it happened so strong, and just like there's a new cultural change happening right now. You know, the new music and the new hairstyles, the new fashion. It's happening very, very fast. And about 2 years from now, there'll be almost a real obvious change, very, very strong. And it happened back then too. By the middle late 70s, the big companies needed imagery. And I was there. I had the images, so they contacted me, and I went with them for the fun of it. I didn't have any idea it would just become so giant. They placed almost $250 million of product on the market in 3 years, which was enormous. And it wasn't so much that they were trying to cash in on, it was more that they were trying to identify. They had lost the touch with a certain segment of the society. They just didn't know how to speak to them. And so, of course, the Beatles did it with their music, and so did all the other groups of those days, musically. But artistically, I think there was nobody around.
So what were your criteria for deciding which offers to accept?
Well, the first offers I accepted, because, you know, I was a fine artist all my life, and when I decided to allow some of the imagery to be reproduced, it was General Electric wanted to do a Peter Max clock. So I did that. And then came a bed sheet company. They wanted to do big sheets. And I didn't want to do that, so they asked if they could show me how one would look. And they reproduced an image that I did that was about the size of a legal pad into a bed sheet. And it was so fabulous looking that I loved it. So I went with that. And there was a tremendous joy in seeing these reproductions. You know, to go to a GE factory that's a quarter of a mile long. A quarter of a mile long, you know, like two blocks long. And the machines that were pumping out these clocks were so vast and so many of them that I thought that every three machines had another clock. And I still remember walking down this tremendous long hallway, and to the right were all these machines, and I was watching clocks come out. Well, I thought I'll be watching two clocks come out of this machine, and the next machine another clock, and the following machine, and then I'll see clocks have nothing to do with Peter Max. Well, I walked for 15 minutes till I reached the machines that I couldn't even see originally that blended, that merged with the dust, you know, about a quarter of a mile down, and those machines were still producing my clocks. It was a tremendous thrill. And at the end of that hallway were the trucks taking it to all the corners of the United States. And I was turned on by that tremendously, to see how art and commerce can really be merged. Because at one time in history, you know, it was totally uncommon for that to happen. And of course, the future is only that. An artist will be famous for his art and for his image, and also will be applied on certain items. It's up to the artist's discretion what to use. I went for quite a few. Actually, if I have to look back right now, maybe out of the 50, 60 companies that I designed for, put my images on, I should rather say, maybe there were 5 or 10 that I should have left out. But all the other ones were fabulous. They were really great.
How did you get involved with the making of Yellow Submarine?
Well, Al Brodax, who's the producer of Yellow Submarine, had a TV series called Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis. And he also had, later on, the Beatles series on TV. But it was a certain cartoon style that was on a corny side, you know, with the hard corners and the overlapping lines. And he came to me, he wanted me to direct that film. And so I styled the film for him. And then just before it was time to direct it, I wasn't able to leave to go to London. He was going to make the film in New York City. So I just gave him all the material and actually sort of set the whole pattern up of the images, the backgrounds, the foregrounds, the kind of line and so forth. And they just went and did that without me. Hans Edelman, a fantastic artist in Germany, took on and took it from there.
Were you satisfied with it?
Oh, yeah. I was very, very happy. And so for the last 4 or 5 years, the same thing has been happening. They wanted me to do films. I'm not ready yet. I think I'll do that maybe in a year from now when I really... I'm just now on the verge of having painted enough. And I'll never stop painting. I'll paint always 10 hours a day. But I feel like doing something else now, and I'm not quite sure if it's a movie or not. But when I saw Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back, and I saw what Lucas did, it's sort of in the same class of what I was thinking of. And I just love what he does.
Were there any artistic conflicts between you and the Beatles during the making of Yellow Submarine?
No, there was none. None. I was very close with John. I knew Yoko 10 years before John even met her. I knew Linda before Paul met her. Linda used to be a freelance photographer. Yoko was an avant-garde artist in the Greenwich Village area. And we were all young artists in those days. And it's funny, you know, we were together and eating in same restaurants, and suddenly she disappeared. And, you know, the word was that she was in London. And then one day on the news, we heard that she married John. Of course, when she brought back John to New York, and I got to meet John, we became fairly good friends.
Mm-hmm. Peter Max is my guest, if you're just joining us. Who do you see as your audience now? Do you feel it's the same audience who has been growing with you?
I don't keep a strong track, but what I hear is it's almost the same audience as I had then. I think in the late 60s and early 70s, the audiences were from 5 years old to 25 or 30. So maybe today they're from 10 years old. I get still in New York when they find the address and so forth. We get still maybe 1,000 letters a month. Every month has been going on for 10 years.
That's a lot of
kids
letters.
sending in tracings of works and art students. It's fabulous. I have such a beautiful collection. I think one day I'll just put out a book on that. I mean, some of the things that kids do after they trace the work or they do their own Peter Max interpretation is so sweet and so great. And there's such innocence in it. They you know, that whole cosmic period has still such an effect on people because it was a very free period when we were really in a change of mind and change of heart and we were into really trying to realize what life is about. You know, every century, every 3-4 decades, there is the decade when we rediscover ourselves. We want to find out, why are we even here? You know, how do we get here? And that's what that art had a lot to do with. That's why I brought the Swami.
Well, you grew up for about 10 years in China.
Yeah.
And went to an English-speaking school there. I imagine you had some American products and toys around. What did you want most when you did move to America after having a taste of it in China?
All right, let me tell you. First of all, when I was in Shanghai once, I had my first cream puff, which I don't know if it's American or not, but when we walked out of that, my father took me and made a big deal about it. He's taking me midtown somewhere for a cream puff. I was about 6 years old. And when we walked out of there, there was this Chinaman sitting with an orange crate and had some colorful books on there. And I wanted these books so bad that my father he was very busy and he wanted me to take me back home. I started to cry and he walked a whole block back and he bought all the books this man had for like a dollar and took them with me, put them in a bag. And I didn't get to see them till we got home. And when we took them out, it turned out to be 22 comic books. They were American comic books. And I had just learned, I was maybe seven, just to read very lightly English I just understood the pictures. And I was so fascinated by the fantasy that came out of these books, only to find out 2-3 years later that these books came from the States. I didn't even know where they came from. I was too young to know that there are other countries on this globe. I thought everybody lived in China. You know, here was a Caucasian kid living in China, and I thought that everybody that was Caucasian, was white, was black, lived in a Chinese community in the same ratio as I did, you know, one Caucasian to about 250,000 Chinese. And of course, when I was about 8 or 9, and the American programs in Shanghai started to play, and I used to hear the jazz. And that knocked me out. And I remember I used to run home after school only to reach up and turn the knob of this big radio that was about my size. And I used to listen to a jazz station, you know, which was before the modern jazz. It was the Dixieland and Glenn Miller. But it was still very bebop-oriented, and it was very American. And I loved that, too. And it was at that point where the comic books and the music, and I got to see some American films, they all merged in my mind. I realized they all came from one place. And that's when I was totally fascinated with America, and I became a tremendous fan. Anything that had anything to do with the United States, I wanted to collect, I wanted to know more about, and including wanting to have a pair of jeans, which was always the biggest thing.
I guess that still is for people not in America.
It was very strong, very big. Now, not as much, mm-hmm. But it was one of the biggest symbols of being, I think, with it, if you had a pair of jeans, if you lived outside the States.
So you think all of that is somehow in your work now? All that kind of love of Americana?
The love of America happened, I think. It's in my work anyhow all the time. And I love the fact that, you know, this place is so free. You know, I feel especially fortunate living here. Having lived in other places, you get to really appreciate the beauty of an incredible democracy, a country that was formed for the purpose of being free. And that's why I did the Liberty Statues of Liberty. And in fact, today I gave the mayor of your city a present of the Liberty Bell, which was by coincidence. When I painted it last night, it was a strange coincidence. I painted this very large painting a few days ago to bring with me to Philadelphia as a tricentennial gift. And when we measured the size of it, so it gets put into our archives, we measured it 76 by 82, which is 1776 by 82 inches. It's very strange that that number came up. I'm not into numerology that much, but that was very interesting.
So how has your work changed? What kind of work are you doing now?
The work I'm doing now, because I painted so strong and constant for the last 10 years, always in my studio, I've gotten into heavy painting, strong paints rather than image making. And it's, I would say, if I had to compare it to anything, it's sort of, it has a little touch of the Impressionist, maybe like Matisse. The most recent paintings are very much like the Fauve artists, who were, they used to call them the wild beasts. They were Europeans who painted, it was post-Impressionism. And the images were real colorful. You know, the skies were yellow, the faces were red and green and deep blue, and hair was pink. And they just went wild with colors. In other words, it had nothing to do with realism except the subject. It's sort of like a new Expressionism today, except it's, I would still think it's more like the Fauve. It's somewhere between the two.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us about your work, and good luck with your show that opens tomorrow at the Halliwell Gallery in Conshohocken, and that will be featuring work from throughout your career.
It has about 15 years of work, and I'll be there on Saturday morning for some of the friends to come by.
Well, let me give the phone number if anyone wants to get more information about the show, and it does open tomorrow at the Halliwell Gallery in Conshohocken. And for more information, you can call 828-8666. That's 828-8666. And good luck with your work. You think you'll be doing a movie in another year?
I think next year I'll move my studio to Hollywood.
Really?
And paint, you know, during the day, or paint at night. I've got to paint 4 or 5 hours a day. I have to do that to keep that creative flow going. And I'll start working and maybe work with a group like the Lucasfilm Group or someone like that. That's my intention.
Well, good luck, and thanks for talking with us. Peter Max has been my guest, and his retrospective show opens tomorrow at the Halliwell Gallery. It's 4:25. This is Fresh Air on 91 FM, and in just a few minutes, we'll be joined by Thomas Keneally, an Australian novelist who wrote The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith in a new book called Schindler's List. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Jackie Byard at the piano from his latest album. It's 4:30. This is Fresh Air on 91FM. Before I introduce my next guest, I want to tell you that a tentative agreement has been reached between the Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News and the union representing the paper's mailers. Those are the men who bundle and sort the papers. A ratification vote has been set for 5 o'clock. It appears that a strike that would have shut down the papers as of this evening has been averted. We'll have details tonight on 91 Report at 6:29, right after All Things Considered. With me now is Thomas Keneally, who has just won the prestigious British Literary Award, the Booker MacDonald Prize for Fiction. His book, which is also published in America, is called Schindler's List, and it's based on the story of Oskar Schindler, a German industrialist, who in the Second World War created a benign work camp and a benign concentration camp. Jews who would otherwise have been killed in real concentration camps were in Schindler's camp, fed well and protected. He did this at constant risk to his own life. Keneally is an Australian, and his other books include Gossip from the Forest, A Season in Purgatory, Confederates, and The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith, which was made into a film in Australia and has been critically acclaimed by American critics. Keneally's new book, Schindler's List, is published by Simon & Schuster. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you indeed.
How did you discover the story of Oskar Schindler?
Well, I walked into the shop that belonged to one of the Schindler Juden, as they call themselves, Schindler Jews. And it was to buy a briefcase desperately needed for a trip back to Australia. And because I had a foreign credit card, it took a little time to process the charges. And in that time, it took over 30 minutes. And in that time, he started talking to me about what I did for a living and where he came from. And then when he found out I was a writer, he said, I've got a book you ought to write. And he went on to say that he'd been saved as a concentration camp prisoner by an extraordinary German called Oskar Schindler. And this German was all the more extraordinary because he was no saint. He was a wild man, a bon vivant, an industrialist. Quite young, only in his early 30s, and that this industrialist, Oskar Schindler, had extracted his wife, the luggage store man's wife, from Auschwitz, along with 300 other women. And to the man in the luggage store, Schindler was something of a god, an ambiguous god, because a god to do with Dionysus, the god of fertility, and with Bacchus, the god of booze, as well as with the gods of deliverance, and but certainly a god. And the man in the luggage store also had a series of documents which he'd collected over the years, which were quite good guide to the basis of the Schindler story. And as a result, I studied what he had and went on to look at other material, did a summary of the Schindler story, and got backing to write it from Simon & Schuster. And not only backing to write it, but backing to undertake a journey of research into a number of countries where Schindler Juden lived and where the evidence could be found.
The first factory that he set up for Jews was an enamelware factory.
Yes.
Would you explain what that was like and maybe what a day in that factory would have been like?
Well, he set up the enamelware factory for his own benefit as well as for the prisoners. And then as the Holocaust took on a definitive form, he built in the backyard of his factory a camp. And into it he put prisoners from a camp called Płaszów. Płaszów was a frightful slave labor camp, very large, on the edge of Krakow. And Oskar extracted his people from there into his camp. Now, he wasn't the only German to use slave labor, but he was the spirit in which the slave labor was used was rather different. In Oscar's camp, as distinct from the other camps of Europe, the SS were kept on the perimeter. Now, the way he was able to keep them on the perimeter was because he knew, had compromised, had bribed, and had dined with all the heavies of the SS in Krakow, including the SS chief of police of Krakow. And he was very well connected with the armaments inspectorate, the German army organization, which gave out war contracts. So he was able to keep the SS on the perimeter by saying to junior SS men, General so-and-so, Oberfuhrer Schirner, General Schindler, he had lucky to have a general of the same name as himself, will be very angry if he knows you've been in here upsetting my essential war workers. Now, they were not essential war workers. In fact, many of them were teenagers. Many of them were totally unskilled and of very little industrial value. But that's the way Schindler operated. So the most remarkable thing for, say, a girl of 22 coming from Płaszów, where there was daily horror on the Appelplatz, the Appellplatz, the roll call, the parade ground area, and where the commandant, Armand Gert, the same age, and a wild German just like Oscar, but an absolute monster. The commandant used to shoot people from his balcony, used to inflict gratuitous cruelties on the parade ground. So to come from the hunger, degradation, disease of Płaszów and be marched up to town and find yourself in this rather eccentric labor camp, where there was a big German called the Herr Direktor, who, whom you saw moving about the factory. And you were astonished that there were no beatings in here. And you were astonished that the soup was thicker, the bread was more copious. And you were astonished that you were left in peace. And the transition made people, in retrospect, call Schindler's camp a paradise. It wasn't, of course, a paradise. They were still prisoners. They had been deprived of many rights, not by Oscar's doing, but by the system. But it was the only place in Europe where they could be with a fair chance of survival. And that remained true of Oscar's camps, both his camps, to the end.
What were the camps like during the war?
Well, these two camps were, as I said, remarkable because no one died in them of malnutrition, of misuse, of having dogs set upon them, of execution on the shop floor for supposed sabotage, of all those classic SS situations. Compare Oscar's camp with the camp of I.G. Farben at Auschwitz III. There were three wings of Auschwitz. It was an enormous complex, a whole duchy. And Auschwitz I was the one, the camp that we encounter in Sophie's Choice, where the commandant Hirsch dwelt. And there were about 20, 30,000 prisoners. Auschwitz II was also called Auschwitz-Birkenau, and it was an enormous complex in which you could fit between 250,000 and 400,000 people at a time. And their main, what would mainly happen to them is that they would progress with varying speed towards the gas chambers at the to the west of the camp and to, into the crematoria. And then there was Auschwitz III, an industrial sector. And that's where the people who had the numbers on their arms worked. Now, in the IG Farben camp in the industrial sector of Auschwitz, 25,000 slave laborers died. They died of malnutrition. They died of beatings. They died of deliberately neglected diseases. They died of executions. And their bodies in both Krupp and Farben were frequently tumbled into pits and simply covered. The contrast between Oscar's camp and the Farben camp, the contrast between Oscar's camp and Płaszów camp, where Armand Gert, a drinking friend of Oscar's, reigned, was quite extraordinary, and it is that which caused people in survivors in who now live in a number of widely separated camps to describe it as paradise. It was a possible existence, and it was an existence in which the Herr Direktor himself would come down to you, a person who had been daily degraded and starved for some years now in the ghetto and in Płaszów. He'd come down to you and perform acts of personal regard or personal, I'm trying to avoid the word kindness, but personal kindnesses. And this astonished prisoners, because as a survivor of the Holocaust said to me, it wasn't the indifference of people that was the trouble. It wasn't that the Germans were indifferent to us or that many of the Poles were indifferent to it, to us. It was that they went out of their way to degrade us. And in Oscar's camp, the opposite was in operation. And therefore, it is hard to overstate the amazement of the prisoner who suddenly found himself in Oscar's camp.
How did prisoners qualify to be in his camp? How did he get? How did he choose them and let them in?
Well, some of them were chosen for industrial reasons. Others, Oscar was very influenced by a particular Jewish intellectual and accountant called Istak Stern, who was, like his father, confessor. Oscar was a Catholic by upbringing, but a very bad Catholic. I mean, he was a hedonist. He didn't believe in the thou shalt not commit adultery. He was a heavy drinker. He was a grand hedonist and absolutely untouched by guilt in matters of sexuality and overindulgence and so on. But he was attracted to Stern's depth and depth of intellect, to Stern's philosophical sort of ambience, because Oscar would have loved to have been a philosopher. He wasn't a philosopher, really. But and Stern became Oscar's, was a prisoner and became Oscar's father confessor. And anyone Stern asked for, if Stern came to him and said, there's a particular group of people I think you ought to get, he'd get them. Anyone that, there are a number of other influential Jewish prisoners who were able to ask him for people. And then another 100 people he acquired by an extraordinary way. There were men from an Auschwitz quarry called Goloschau, and they'd been put in railway cars and shunted all over Central Europe for a week in the middle of the winter of 44-45. They were sealed inside these carriages without food, without water, without sanitation, and the ones who survived, survived by scraping ice off the walls. They turned up in the railway depot near Oscar, and Oscar signed for them and took them into his factory. The doors had to be welded open, and inside was some 16, 17 dead men and over 100 still living, absolutely skeletal. Now, he took these people into his factory and put them on his books as skilled, essential war workers, which was not only an act of generosity, it was an act of hide, of sass. It was an act it was an extravagant act. It was something that very few other men would have been game enough to do. And none of those men worked for the rest of the war. They were merely tendered there. And so he would collect people that way. He also, in his second camp, he had two camps, one in Czechoslovakia, was in Poland, and the second in Czechoslovakia. Escaped prisoners who were picked up by the Gestapo in Moravia, in the Czechoslovak province of Moravia, were handed over to Oscar. He had an arrangement with the Gestapo that cost money, and some 20 or so prisoners came his way that way. He acquired a further 30 tinsmiths, metal workers, from Auschwitz. He acquired the 300 women from Auschwitz, most of whom were of no industrial value to him. And, of course, the Holocaust had an industrial, an economic side to it, and one of the aspects of the economic side was that you had to pay the SS for your slave labor. For women, you had to pay 5 marks a day, and for skilled, unskilled labor, 6 marks a day, and for skilled, unskilled male labor, that is, and for skilled male labor, you had to pay 7.50 a day. And Oscar went on paying for these people, even though they were of no industrial value to him at all. They were people who in any other camp would have simply been shoveled into the corner and then covered. There's no doubt about that.
I know that he was bribing the SS and German officials who he knew, and that he'd pal around with them. Still, it's hard for me to believe that he was able to pull it off, and that that in spite of the bribes, that he wasn't put into a camp himself.
Well, one of the reasons was economic. You know, I mean, as reasons often are. And it was the nature of the camp system. If you were commandant of a big camp like Płaszów or like Gross Rosen, and you had a number of little camps all round you, little slave labor camps, you were supposed to supply them in certain ways. You were supposed to supply them with guards, and you were supposed to supply those guards with food, and you were supposed to supply the prisoners with a certain amount of food, and other materials were to be supplied to the sub-camp. Now, if you had a camp manager like Oscar, whom you knew had the Jewish virus, he had this softness for Jews, you know. Okay, well, you knew you didn't have to supply him. You knew that what you were supposed to supply to him, you could sell on the black market. And you could yet write down in your books that you'd sent it to him, and you knew he wouldn't complain. You knew that he would himself feed his prisoners off the black market. And therefore, it was a very profitable business for a camp commandant. The first camp commandant, Oscar, whose system Oscar had to deal with, was this Armin Gert, a man of the same age, same background as Oscar, but a living horror. And he and Oscar were linked together by mutual interest. It suited Oscar because to have his own camp, because it was a means of preserving a pocket of people intact. It suited Armin Gert because it was a means for him to dispose of material which should have gone to Oscar's camp on the black market. So they survived for, those people survived partly for economic reasons. The same when Oscar incredibly managed to talk the German authorities into opening the first slave labor camp in Moravia against the opposition of the Gauleiter of Moravia. He managed to bribe and bluff, and at last he founded a camp in Czechoslovakia to which he brought the people he extracted from Auschwitz and so on. And once more, he was under the overall management, in theory, of the commandant of Gross Rosen, a terrible camp in Upper Silesia. The commandant's name was Haysbrook. Now, Haysbrook knew that having Oscar there, he could come down, and he used to come down to Oscar's camp, and he'd collect the SS charges for the slave labor, and he was making deductions for himself. And he was able to accept from Oscar enormous gifts, because Oscar was right in the black market. Oscar pursued the black market with gusto. I mean, as incredible as it sounds, the last 8 months of the war, Oscar's camp in Czechoslovakia produced nothing of any industrial value. It ran on the black market. He had a man who is now an Israeli Supreme Court judge forging stamps for him so that they could run round Moravia and up to Poland and collect stuff and bring in food and cigarettes and cognac from Poland to Czechoslovakia or take it from Czechoslovakia into Poland and trade. And it's the evidence for all this, I might say, is impeccable. But unfortunately, when you say it in brief, it sounds like an episode of Hogan's Heroes. And so despite the fact that Oscar's camp was so erratic and eccentric, it's Oscar had access to great goods. He was a if there was a prize for black marketeers, he'd be certainly on the shortlist. And he was able to, therefore, to supply personnel such as the commandant of Gross Rosen with what they wanted. So once more, the SS, their attitude was, we'll get all these prisoners in the end. Their attitude to him, though, was that he was a good chap, a great drinker, a great party giver and goer, and a great source of contraband materials, black market goods. But he had the Jewish virus, and he was to be more pitied. Mind you, he was arrested 3 times by the SS, but always released. And every time it was due to the fact that he had a Polish girlfriend called Klonowska, who used to call round a standard list of influential Germans. One was the SS chief of police for Krakow. Another one was a German intelligence agent in Breslau. Another one was the German chairman of a big steelworks in Sosnowiec, near Auschwitz, who supplied Oscar with the steel for his factory. And there were others. And she'd call all these people and say, Oscar's worried that if they go on in interrogating him, he's going to have to tell them about his special relationship with you. And as a result, Oscar was 3 times sprung from 3 extremely dangerous imprisonments. Well, one was a little bit ridiculous, actually. One of the times he was arrested, it was because he'd kissed some Jewish prisoners, girls, at his birthday party. It was the only concentration camp in Europe where the Herr Direktor's birthday was celebrated by the prisoners.
Thomas Keneally is my guest if you're just joining us, and we're discussing the subject of his new book, Schindler's List, which is the story of Oscar Schindler. Which is also amazing to me that when the war ended, he ended up in a series of business failures and was actually quite poor.
Yeah, during the war, of course, he had some very bright people running the place for him. He had accountants like Isaac Stern, he had administrators like his friend Roman Ginter, he had engineers like Adam Garda, and as a result, the whole thing swung along very nicely. But after the war, he had no one to look after business drudgery, and all the fun went out of life anyhow because there's no black market. And he did go bankrupt twice and became absolutely dependent on the people he'd saved.
This really sounds like a potential subject for a movie. Have you gotten offers yet?
Yes, we have got offers. They look firm, even to an old hack like me who's been down the movie trail so often. They look very firm. I would be surprised if it wasn't ultimately made into a film. I'd be very surprised. I'm fairly confident that it will be.
One of your novels that was made into a film was The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith,
mm-hmm.
A film that I very much enjoyed. Were you satisfied with it? Did it adhere to your novel?
No, it's made by a very good friend of mine, so I'm in an awkward situation. But and a great movie maker called Fred Skepsi, who's now moved to Beverly Hills and made a film called Barbarossa, which got good reviews lately. But as Fred knows, I didn't fully like it, but the author never does. So there's nothing new about that. Pauline Kael liked it. That was the most important thing. Pauline Kael's a more important liker than I am. And it wasn't because Fred tried to diminish the subject or the author just never likes it. And even with Fred, Fred asked me to write the script, and I said no, that I felt that I was too far away from the book now. So he gave me every opportunity to be part of it. And it is a fine and remarkable movie, and he's a fine and remarkable filmmaker. In fact, you know, people in Hollywood consider him an enormously prestigious and successful director. And you tell him, and he says, "Oh God, I wish they'd let me know in a more concrete manner." But he is a great director.
The film is about a young man who's half white Australian and half Aboriginal. Did you do a lot of research on
yes,
Aboriginal
a fair amount of research. I grew up in a town that had lots of Aboriginals living on the outskirts, and I became fascinated with the whole question then. And
what's the question?
Well, the question is the question of the two races and of the two laws, both the two LAWS and the two LORES, and the two ways of looking at the earth. I would like, even though a European can't really do it, maybe Gunter Grass could do it, but I would really like to do a book which looks at the two worlds, the world that the Aboriginal sees and the world that we see, because they're not the same planet. It's like the Middle Earth. It's as different, the earth in which they live. I mean, just an obvious example is that what to us is desert is to them the Garden of Eden. They can eat smorgasbord at every step, and they are not outraged by the lack of surface water. They know where the water is. It's safe. It's away from, you know, and they find it quite acceptable that in an area where you get 200 millimetres of rain a year and the evaporation rate is about 15 times that, it is best that the water be safely underground, deep in the sand or deep in the rock. And being Eurocentric, we're appalled by all that. Now, I would like to attempt to dramatise the two cultures, but particularly that culture, that other world, that other planet, that we know nothing of. It's the same ground we occupy as them, but it's a different planet. This Australian summer, I was way out on the Northern Territory, Western Australian border, very remote, you know, practically the pole of inaccessibility for Australia. And there are some beautiful mountains out there, which one of which women never look at, you know, and Pitjantjatjara tribes women have been there for some 30,000 years, and generation by generation, they don't look at this mountain for 30,000 years. And there are mountains that the men don't look at, and there are places the women don't go, and there are places the men don't go. There are areas of language which you can't use with certain people, or which you can't use at all. There are some people to whom you can't speak, and some people at whom you can't look. There are good ritual and tribal reasons for all this, but it is a fantastic arrangement of society, and yet it works, and yet it works. And then there's the separate law and the separate medicine, and Aboriginals lead extraordinarily dramatic lives. It's not enough to keep all of them off the booze, but then our dreaming, they speak of the dreaming, the time in which the earth was made by the hero ancestors, and that's only yesterday. It's all a continuum. Them and the hero ancestor, they're very familiar to each other. And in our dreaming is not enough to keep all of us off the booze either.
Well, I really look forward to reading your next novel or seeing the film that develops from this idea.
Okay.
I really regret we're out of time. Time went very quickly. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Not at all. It was a great pleasure. Thank you.
Thomas Keneally has been my guest. He's an Australian writer, and he was just talking about Aboriginal culture in Australia, and he wrote the novel The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith, upon which the film was based. His new book, Schindler's List, is about the story of Oskar Schindler, who had kind of like alternative concentration camps during the Second World War, in which he protected Jews from the real concentration camps and also was very active in the black market trade. Schindler's List has just received a very prestigious British Literary Award. In America, it's published by Simon & Schuster. Well, I want to tell you that a tentative agreement has been reached between the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Daily News and Union representing the paper's mailers, and we'll have more details on that this evening at 6:29 on 91 Report. Monday afternoon on Fresh Air at 2 o'clock, we'll be joined by Dr. Randall Sword, author of a new book called Emergency Room, and he's an emergency room doctor. Then we'll be joined by someone who's put together a mock catalog, a kind of parody of the L.L. Bean catalog. And he's really obsessed with the Bean catalog. So he'll be with us at about 2:30 on Monday, 3:30 Judy Stein, 4 o'clock we continue the Billy Taylor series, and the subject will be bebop piano. So I hope you can be with us then. Bill Van Wert contributed to this afternoon's Fresh Air. Ron Carson was the technical director. Maeve McGoran is the production assistant. Danny Miller is the associate producer of the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I wish you a very good evening and a very good weekend. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, where listeners supported public radio in the Delaware Valley. Stay tuned now for All Things Considered.
Support for this program comes from the NPR News and Information Fund. Contributors include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, for Midwestern coverage, the Joyce Foundation, the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation for reporting on biological resource issues, and RKO General, a radio and television broadcasting company. This program is a production of National Public Radio, which is solely responsible for its content.